So we're going to look at Psalm 121 today. And as I was reading through this psalm, as I was meditating on it, a silly thought struck me, actually, especially with the first verse, that this psalm is very Shakespearean. Now, I'm not into Shakespeare at all. In fact, as I was going to mention later on, I failed my O-level English, both literature and language, back in 1959. So that's not me at all. But it was just the opening of this psalm. It really struck me. So I thought perhaps we'd bring in someone to do the reading of Shakespearean experience. And so what I want to do is to just play this bit of video now. Are we ready? It's on? Ah, right. Yes. So here we have a professional
actor. Psalm 121. I lift up my eyes to the mountains. Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. He will not let your foot slip. He who watches over you will not slumber. Indeed, he who watches over Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord watches over you. The Lord is your shade at your right hand. The sun will not harm you by day, nor the moon by night. The Lord will keep you from all harm. He will watch over your life. The Lord will watch over your coming and going, both now and forevermore.
Only just 8 verses, but you know, there's so much in those 8 verses. I didn't realise when I'd offered to talk on Psalm 121 that there was so much to find out. But I don't know whether you're with me there, that those first 2 verses. And I'm not an actor at all, but I just could imagine someone saying, I lift my eyes up to the hills, where comes my help? And so I thought I'd employ David Suchet to do that bit for us, actually. An amazing psalm in many ways. If you've got a Bible, or if you look at it on your phone, you'll notice that the heading is a psalm or a song of ascents. Now, just a word of explanation there. There are 15 psalms of ascents, songs of ascents, and they start at Psalm 120 and go through to Psalm 134. They're all psalms of ascents. And I wondered what ascent really meant. You know, ascent has got the idea to me of going up, ascending somewhere. And when I looked into this, there are actually two, but we don't really know what this means exactly, but there are two possible meanings. And the first meaning comes from the Mishnah, which is a set of rabbinic traditions. And I'm going to read this. But it states that within the temple courtyard, which is there, there are 15 steps there, which move from the court of the women here, the court of the women. I don't know if it's called the court of the women because it's for everybody. It's where anybody, everybody can actually go, but it's actually called the court of the women. Sorry, wrong way. And it goes into this next court here, which is the hall of the Israelites. And although it's not shown here, there's a few steps there. There are actually 15 steps there. And you can read about those in the book of Ezekiel. And apparently, it says here, the Levites on harps and on lyres and with cymbals and with trumpets and with other instruments of music without number sing hymns on each step. This corresponds to the 15 songs of ascent in Psalms. So that's one possibility or probability. But the alternate meaning, which I think is the most widely accepted one, is that these songs were sung by Israelites when they were on a pilgrimage. And normally that pilgrimage would be to Jerusalem, to the temple, for one of probably the 3 main festivals which they would travel to Jerusalem for. One was Passover, as we know, but the others were the Feast of Weeks and the Feast of Tabernacles. So it's very likely that as they were walking along, as they were on this pilgrimage, a physical pilgrimage, they would be singing these various psalms of ascent. And as I say, there are 15 of them there. Let me come back to that. Now, what made me think about Psalm 121? Well, it started back in February this year, actually. And Jenny and I were reading through the Book of Psalms. Well, we dived into the Book of Psalms. We started at Psalm 100. I don't know why, but we just said, let's read Psalm 100 and move on from there. And this was in January, I think. And so we started reading through the various Psalms. And we got to Psalm 121 on about the 15th of February, end of the second week of February, something like that. And yes, we did read the whole of Psalm 119, okay? All 170-odd verses of it. So yes, we not in one go, though. So we did deal with that. Now, at that time, about the 15th of February, our very, very good friend, Dick Chammings, and a friend of the church, and my daughter's father-in-law, was very near death. He'd been very unwell for many months, and he was really going through it. And our son-in-law, Chris, was very, very low at this time, very low indeed. And we read this psalm one day, and I just thought as we read it, I'm going to pass this on to Chris, because there's a lot here that is very supportive. And so I did. And so that's what brought it back to my mind. In fact, Dick, our friend, died just 3 days later on the 18th of Feb. So it was actually perhaps opportune, but that was God, not me. So let's dive into this psalm. And the psalm basically divides itself into two very clear parts. The first two verses, a traveller's question and confession. I lift up my eyes to the hills. Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. And then the rest of the psalm is verses 3 through to 8, which is really a priestly blessing. And that's really what I want to perhaps concentrate on. But first, let's just have a look at those first two verses. A traveller's question. The psalm begins with this question, doesn't it? Where can I get help from? Or where can I look to for help? You ever been in a situation when something goes wrong, or you're in a situation that you're not able to cope with, and you should probably ask for help, but don't ask for help? I know I've been in that situation many, many times, as Jenny will attest to as well, that I'm very bad at asking for help. Why don't we ask for help? Well, I don't know. But in my case, I can only talk for myself, I think it's probably stubbornness and pride in the main. I know where I'm going. I don't need to ask directions. I know exactly which turning to turn and which way to go. No, I'm not going to ask for help. Do you know the sort of, I expect you some of you, I see some smiles on some faces there, so some of you have obviously been there. Yeah, mine is stubbornness and pride, but there could well be other reasons. I can do this. I can sort this problem out on my own. I don't need help. This is a tendency, a human tendency, I think, to refuse help or to pretend that we don't actually need help in the first place. And this can make for life to be very difficult at times, if not impossible, especially on our journey of faith. You see, faith means that from the very beginning that we acknowledge there is a higher power at work in the world, and that's God, and that we are not God. Now, that's a difficult thing to acknowledge sometimes for some people. The famous, that's the first two verses. The famous Reformed theologian, John Calvin, actually says this. He said, "We humans are utterly dependent on God. We can do nothing apart from God." And when you think about it, that's absolutely right, isn't it? We can't do anything without God. Although we do try. So can this psalm help in this way at all? Well, the Israelites, let's go back to the actual context of the psalm. The Israelites are on a pilgrimage. They're on the way to Jerusalem. Now, that physical journey is a journey which is surrounded by hills. Jerusalem is on a hill. And we read in the Bible of other hills in the area. Now, that's both good and bad when you think about it. Because the hills can give a feeling of security by their natural defensibility. But they can also give cover to bands of robbers just waiting to step out and to rob the unsuspecting traveller. So the hills are good and the hills are bad. But they are God's creation. And this is what the psalmist reminds the listeners of here. You know, I lift my eyes to the hills. My help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth, the maker of these hills around us that you're looking at now. So the psalmist's question is quite a natural one. I lift my eyes to the hills. Where does my help come from? Now, the Israelites, they're on a pilgrimage, on a physical journey. But, you know, we can also apply this, I think, to other journeys, to our life's journey. Because our life's journey, if we think about it, is probably full of ups and downs. And I've lived quite a long life now, and Jan and I have had many ups and downs in our lives. I've personally had many ups and downs in that life. And God has never promised that when we commit our life to him, that we will never have to face any of these life's difficulties. Back to readings that Jenny and I do, we've just started reading in Job. And this week, it suddenly struck me that Job was in this sort of situation. I'll just read a bit. Satan left God and struck Job with terrible sores. Job was ulcers, and this is from the Message. Job was ulcers and scabs from head to foot. They itched and oozed so badly that he took a piece of broken pottery to scrape himself, then went and sat on a trash heap amongst the ashes. His wife said, "Dear wife, still holding to your precious integrity, are you? Curse God and be done with it." He told her, this is Job, you're talking like an empty-headed fool. We take the good days from God, why not also the bad days? And I thought, wow, doesn't that just apply to life? Yes, we have good days, and they're brilliant days, but we do get bad days. I'm not saying necessarily that God gives us those bad days, but in Job's case, he allowed Satan to give Job a really rough time. And I think that's what happens to us today. But we have many, I think, difficulties to face as we go through life. And I've just listed a few of them now. We get physical difficulties. Disease, injury, accident, tragedy, war, infirmity, natural disasters. The list could go on. Our lives are full of various downs, and these are some of them. And then we get relational difficulties, problems and difficulties that come in our relationships with other people. Relationships go up, relationships go down, particularly true in families and family units and that sort of thing, but between friends, between work colleagues, with other people that we meet. We have these relationship problems. But we are made by God to be relational. That's what we're made to be. So the going is not always going to be smooth. And then there are economic ups and downs in lives. Today, we hear about the cost of living, and that's a big concern to many, many people. Other things like the threat of unemployment, perhaps in a job, or debt if we've got money problems, or maybe the country going into recession, or whatever it might be. These are some of the downs, if you like, economically. And the last one I want to mention, the spiritual. We get all sorts of spiritual ups and downs. Downs like doubt. Do you often have doubt? Do you ever doubt God's there? Do you ever doubt that he's really helping you? Other doubts come into our minds, don't they? Sin and evil. fundamentalism, extremism, false teaching, all sorts of things that affect our spiritual life. What's the answer? The answer is in this psalm. My help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. So whatever hits us in life's journey, whatever it is, we need to go back, I think, to this psalm and to verse 2 here. My help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. That little word help, you know, that's quite important. It's only four letters, but it contains so much within that word. Because that word help, and putting it into this context as well, it can mean to protect, to guard, to watch over, to guide, to take care of. That's what God does for us. That's his help. So on this journey, the journey that the Israelites are making, or the journey of life, the hills, the ups and downs will obscure some threat. But they also bear witness, as I said earlier on, of the Creator, because God is the maker of heaven and earth. And that's very important, I think, for us to bear in mind. So let's look at the second part of this psalm. I don't know where you can see this very well. But these are the first two verses. And the first two verses say, I will lift up my eyes to the hills. Where does my help come from? My help comes from the Lord. And so the first two verses here, the pronouns are all first person, me and my. But you notice when we get to verse 3 through to 8, it switches, because it then goes over to you and your. And the feeling here is that this psalm is designed for two different speakers. The first is to offer the challenge, if you like, probably a priestly figure, whereas the second one is perhaps a priest giving a blessing. And this part of this psalm is can be looked upon as a blessing. The other thing to notice too about this psalm and the second group of verses is six times in six verses, the phrase or the sentence, he who watches over you, or he who keeps you. If you look in the AV, it says all about keeper and keeps. Six times in six verses. And this really is the key to the psalm. He who watches over you. Who is he? He's the maker of heaven and earth that is mentioned in verse 2. He is the guardian of the pilgrim. And you know, he's the guardian of every believer as well. He's the guardian of you and of me and of every single believer. Oh, I'm going to skip the next bit because I don't understand it. perhaps I'll just mention, you know, sometimes you can analyse scripture too deeply, I think. And some of the commentaries I read on this passage, one of them talks in terms that I really didn't understand. It talks about verses 3 to 8 having two legs. And those legs were based on masculine singular particular form. And the other one was masculine singular imperfect form. Now, I haven't the faintest idea what they're about. As I said, I failed O-level English. I couldn't care less, because I don't think it makes much difference to the meaning of the psalm anyway. But it just shows you that you can really get deeply into this, can't you? Okay, let's look. Time's going. Verses 3 and 4. I've headed as the ever-vigilant guardian. Verse 3. He will not let your foot sleep. Who is God? God is our keeper. God's identity is to protect, to shield, to watch over, to guard us, to keep us. Very much like, as mentioned in some of the other psalms, like a watchman looking over a city. In Psalm 121, we read this, unless the Lord watches over the city, the guards stand watch in vain. So although guards are posted, it's God who's actually looking over the city. He's the watchman, he's the keeper. And the other illustration of this, I suppose, is a bird on a nest. And we read about this again in several places, but in Psalm 97, it says this: He, God, will cover you with his feathers, and under his wings you will find refuge. His faithfulness will be your shield and rampart. Do you ever watch Spring Watch? We love Spring Watch, actually. And especially the spring one. Well, that is Spring Watch, isn't it? But you, that they often focus on birds' nests. And, you know, they might be watching a particular nest, like a blackbird's nest or something like that, and the weather turns. Yeah, and you've seen it. The weather turns, it's pouring down with rain, and they home in onto this nest. And what do they see? They see one of the male birds, probably the mother bird, covering the whole nest with its wings. The whole, so that all the youngsters underneath are safe and secure. I think that's an amazing picture of God's care for us, of God's provision for us, for his guardianship of us. I'm not meant to do any more. The other little thing I just want to pick out of this verse, he will not let your foot slip. He who watches over you will not slumber. And I thought, well, that's an interesting phrase, actually. But when I looked into it, I found references to other deities in countries around Israel who have all these various gods. And it was a common belief amongst many of Israel's neighbours that their gods did sleep, or they had died, especially during the winter months, which I found a little bit strange, and revived in seasons of growth and harvest. So I think here the psalmist is having a little go at the nations around Israel. You know, your God sleep, but our God never sleeps. He never slumbers. He keeps constant watch over its pilgrims. He keeps constant watch over us. Very quickly, this reminded me of Elijah in Book of Kings. Do you remember when the country was in dire drought? Ahab was the king. Ahab refused to call on God for help. There's a good illustration. You know, I can do it myself, because he actually sent people out to find every stream and river in the whole country to find a bit of water. He forgot to ask God. He didn't want to. Anyway, Elijah said, well, I can bring the rain. God's going to bring the rain. And Ahab said, no, God, there's no such God. So Elijah set up this situation, didn't he, on Mount Carmel. Do you remember the lovely story where he builds an altar? And he says to all these prophets of Baal and the prophets of Asherah, 850 of them in total, he said, right, come on in, gather round, call upon your gods to light this sacrifice. No, you're not having any matches, you're not having any light thing, you know. You call upon your God to do this. Well, they danced and they jumped and they prayed and they did all sorts of things for hours upon hours. In fact, even jumping on the altar and demolishing the altar. But nothing happened. So what did Elijah do? He rebuilt the altar. Not only did he rebuild it with the wood and he put the animal on it, he then got 12 buckets of water and he poured it all over the sacrifice and he called upon God. And that moment, the rain came down and it lit the sacrifice. But the thing I wanted to say was that Elijah's taunting of the prophets of Baal and that, he said to them, shout louder, surely he is God. Perhaps he is deep in thought or busy or travelling. Maybe he's sleeping and must be awakened. So you've got this reference here to other gods. Anyway, moving on very quickly. God's unfailing protection. Verse 5, the Lord watches over you. It's interesting here. He goes on to say, the Lord is your shade at your right hand. The sun will not harm you by day or the moon by night. Now, we can understand the sun harming us on a journey, on a pilgrimage, can't we? You know, if it's hot sun, as it's been for a few weeks now, and we go out protected, there's a good chance of sunstroke, there's a good chance of sunburn. So we understand that. but the moon, the sun will not harm you by day, nor the moon by night. And I thought, now, what harm can the moon give us? But it's quite interesting because the basic word for moon is lunar. And it's from that base that we get the word lunacy. And there is a common feeling that the moon can introduce all sorts of strange things, including lunacy. Just read something here. Belief in the lunacy effect, or the Transylvania effect, as it's sometimes called, persisted in Europe through the Middle Ages, when humans were widely reputed to transmogrify into werewolves or vampires during the full moon. What a lovely word, eh? Transmogrify. I hadn't come across that before. But there is this belief that the moon is harmful. And the strange thing is, and this is actually only when we started, when we first came down here, Open Door, we started a project under Open Door called Night Shift, a bit like Street Pastors. And a number of us were involved in going out into Exmouth Town late on Saturday night to help those in distress, those that had too much to drink, whatever it might be. And you know, there was a distinct feeling amongst all of us that if that Saturday night was a full moon night, we were going to get a lot more trouble than normal. And it happened. It's strange, isn't it? You know, you can't put your finger on it, but that was how it was. Shakespeare said in Othello, here's my literature coming out, it is the very error of the moon. She comes more near to the earth than she was wont and makes men mad. So even Shakespeare acknowledged that we got this problem. When I was looking at this verse, it made me think about the song that we sing, not so much nowadays, but one of the things that the kids sing and love it. My God is so big, my God is so strong, there's nothing my God cannot do. And lastly, oh, missed that, didn't I? Oh, not to worry. Lastly, God's assurance. The last three verses, the Lord will keep you from all harm. He will watch over your life. The Lord will watch over your coming and going, both now and forevermore. The phrase here about coming and going seems to refer to city life at this time. The Israelis would understand. Many of them would live within the walled security of Jerusalem or another walled city. And in the mornings, they'd go out of the city into the fields in to do their work around. And then at the end of the day, they'd come back in to the security of the city which was then closed up and which, as we've already seen, would have watchmen. So what does God promise to do? He promises to keep us, to watch out for us, to guard us as we go on our journey of life. And he doesn't do that just today, he does that forevermore. So I think it's an amazing psalm. And just really to sum up quickly, Psalm provides, I think, the words of assurance that if us, the faithful people, we believers, keep our eyes squarely on God, Yahweh, the source of our help, the maker of heaven and earth, who does not slumber, will indeed guard and keep watch over and protect us and be our shade and be our protector. If we take our eyes off the source of our assuredness, when we look to other mountains around us and we take our eyes off of God, then things can go wrong. We must all remember, as the psalmist says, right at the beginning, we must lift up our eyes to the mountains because their help comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth.